I'll see you Monday.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the program. It is Friday night. I love Fridays. And let me tell you something. For this Friday, do I ever have a lineup for you? Do you remember the name Chris Watts? Of course you remember the name Chris Watts. How could you forget Chris Watts? I mean, that's really one of the most hated names in true crime, right? Look, it turns out that even after killing his pregnant wife and his two beautiful little daughters, he still hasn't learned his lesson. Even after cooling his heels for 6 months in prison, knowing he's got five life sentences, guess who he's blaming now for that family annihilation that he committed? Women. Women. Women are to blame, and he's naming them. And he's got all sorts of names for them, too, especially the woman he was cheating on his wife with right before he decided to murder his wife and kids. So I've got the letters that he's had in his cell that he's been writing. Top of your head's just going to pop right off on this one. And then also, this was a mystery for months. Rachel Morin, a mother of five, she goes out for a run, as we all do, in Maryland on the Maupas Trail, and then is found dead. And it was almost a year before we could find a person suspected of killing her. It was an undocumented immigrant, and his trial began today. And so often is the case, the details that we learned today are just unimaginable, starting with a 150-foot-long trail of blood. I'm going to take you through everything that happened today, the list of evidence that's against him, and the list that his defense says will clear him. That's coming up in just a moment. And then I know you've heard of road rage. Have you ever heard of boat rage? Because tonight I'm going to give you a very good example of boat rage, especially this kind. Have you ever tried to be in an argument with someone and they're yelling so much they cannot hear your explanation? I give you this.
Like what? What are you trying to do? Act like a tough guy in front of your buddies?
No, I'm not. Dude, all these motherfuckers know I'm tough, motherfucker.
Bro, all right, bro.
Please, bro. Please, bro. Please, bro. Bro, I'm a kid, bro. Please.
An innocent kid out fishing against a rage monster of the sea. And it's a full video you really have to see to believe. And that is coming up. You and 15 million people, by the way. Let me start here, though. As true crime stories go, the Chris Watts family annihilation case was as gripping as the Idaho murders, Casey Anthony, and Jody Arias. In a nutshell, Chris Watts decided in 2018 that his pregnant wife, Shanann, and his two adorable girls, Bella and Celeste, they were just a drag on his new lifestyle. And by lifestyle, I mean the hot coworker that he started sleeping with every chance he got. Instead of just leaving Shanann, he decided to wipe her out of the picture altogether, and then for good measure, wipe out those two precious babies too. And when he did that, he did it in the worst way. And I will get into that in just a moment. But it appears that Chris Watts has now decided it wasn't his fault. Get a drink. In some never-before-seen prison letters, he lays out who's really to blame for the horrors that he visited on his young family. And the guilty party? Women. Multiple women, everyone from his mistress to past girlfriends, and of course to that pregnant wife of his. He also reaches the conclusion that, quote, he is a good person. And how exactly does he get there? Because that is rich. And I'm going to get to that in a moment, too. First, though, a refresher. Chris Watts killed his wife in their bedroom. And when his eldest daughter walked in and asked, what's wrong with mommy? He lied to her, saying, mommy's sick and needs to go to the hospital. So then he loaded up his wife's body and his two little girls alive into his truck. And he drove 45 minutes in the middle of the night to this place, a crude oil storage site, a work site of his. He dug a grave for their mom and tossed her into it. And then one by one, he strangled his baby daughters. First Celeste, the younger one, and then Bella, who fought like hell. But instead of burying his babies like he did their mother, he chose to jam their lifeless little bodies through 8-inch hatches in 2 separate oil tanks. He shoved them through those hatches so forcefully that Bella's body was scratched and scraped throughout, and a tuft of her blonde hair was stuck on the edge. For 4 days, the bodies of those little girls were floating inside those tanks in that filthy crude oil. Naturally, when his family went missing, people started asking questions. And Chris Watts' answer? It was classic Susan Smith. He blamed the pregnant wife that he murdered, saying that Shanann must have run off with my babies. And then he looked right into the cameras and he begged you and me and all of us to help him find his family.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's going to have their own opinion on anything like this. I just want them people to know that I want my family back. Like, I want them safe, and I want them here. Like, this house is not the same. I mean, last night was traumatic. Last night was, I can't really stay in this house again.
No, you can't stay in that house, right? But for a reason that we all now know. If you don't already hate this despicable piece of waste, there is something else that might make your blood boil. It seems the 5 life sentences with no parole has taught him nothing. Chris Watts has decided he is not to blame for what happened to Shanann and to Bella and to Celeste and his unborn son. Nope. The women in his life are to blame. The Daily Mail just got its hands on some letters written by Watts at the Dodge Correctional Institute. That is a maximum security prison in central Wisconsin where he was sent. And he has been there for the last 6 years. The letters show a man determined to find anyone but himself responsible for his diabolical behavior. He actually addressed his letters to God, zip code unknown. And he first unloads on his mistress, Nicole Kessinger, writing this. I was misled. I was tempted by a harlot. I was weak, and I allowed myself to be fooled by an evil woman. She led me from the path of righteousness. I know that you will deal with her someday. She will be judged. You know my heart, Lord. I am a man after your heart. I seek your face. I allowed her to sway me. FYI, Nicole Kessinger told the police that she was dating a man who told her that he was separated and divorcing. But then when his wife and children disappeared, she got very scared and she called the police immediately, leading to his arrest. But Watts doesn't stop with Nicole Kessinger. No, no, no. He unloads on other women too, mostly unnamed women, calling them harlots and Jezebels and whores. And of course, he blames his pregnant wife for being domineering and self-absorbed, suggesting that she caused her own death. Like, I just threw up in my mouth. What is weird is that he doesn't seem to have it in for all women, because plenty of his letters are addressed to female pen pals. And get this, he seems to be looking for a new wife. My next guest broke this story. Steve Helling is a senior reporter with the Daily Mail. He is top-notch in true crime. He's a friend of the show, and he's a good friend of mine. Steve, I should have called you for a drink before you came on the air, as opposed to going for drinks after work, because I couldn't unclench my teeth while reading your piece. So just start with what else you got on what he writes about women.
I should have warned you, first of all. Let's start there.
Yeah.
I got my hands on these letters. You know, I've seen a lot of his letters. I know his handwriting. I know his writing style. And the thing about Chris Watts is that he couches everything that he writes in this spiritual Christianity type of thing that isn't like any Christianity that I know, that basically he doesn't take personal responsibility. He was always tempted. He was always weak. Somebody was always pulling him aside. And that somebody was always, always a woman. You know, she was a whore. She was a harlot. You know, she tempted me with her soft words and with her lips. It makes me think, can you take any responsibility whatsoever for what you did? And it seems like he
can't. Turns out, no. Yeah, so he says in a letter that you got your hands on, quote, the lips of an immoral woman may be smooth, but no amount of paint on her face can disguise her evil heart. So now I guess it's the makeup's fault for what he did. But he doesn't seem to hate all women. He seems to really want a new one. What is the story about the search for a wife? Is there anybody who's actually interested?
Well, I mean, we see this all the time. You know, Chris Watts is not a bad-looking person. And, you know, there's always going to be somebody who's interested in him. And so there are women that write to him, and he writes back. You know, he's actually very good at corresponding. And, of course, you know, a lot of the times he's just talking about, you know, it's a lot of spiritual stuff that he talks about, a lot of Christianity, a lot of God, a lot of Jesus. But then, you know, he'll sometimes talk about himself and be like, you know, I'm misunderstood. And, you know, I was a good father. I was a good person until something happened, but I'm still a good person. So, you know, it's interesting what he'll say to these women. And, you know, a lot of these women, they do fall for it. They do think, well, maybe he's changed. Maybe he's a better person than I thought he was.
I want to pop that piece back up there. We just had it up on the screen, but I want to read it. It was this business about being a good person. I'm barfing in my mouth. He says, I was a good husband and father. Things happened. Things happened. And I am no longer a good husband and father, but I am still a good man. Is this something he wrote to someone in particular, trying to convince her that he'd be her knight in shining armor?
He wrote this to a woman. And, you know, I really, when I read it, I thought, things happen. I mean, things happen like, you know, like it starts to rain. That's something that happens. What doesn't generally just happen is that you strangle your wife, smother your children, and bury their bodies in an oil field. That's not something just happening. So it just shows, even his choice of words, that none of this is his fault. He didn't do anything. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, boy, I'll say. He doesn't even acknowledge any of the evil that he committed, it seems. And he's still blaming Shanann. He is still blaming the woman who was pregnant with his unborn son. They were going to name that son Nico. I mean, they had been talking about this baby. There was all sorts of social media about the excitement of having this baby boy. They talked about the name Nico. But yet he still takes massive pot shots at the woman he murdered.
I mean, it's really interesting. This is the blame the victim type of thing. And look, I'm not saying they had a perfect marriage. I'm sure that there were issues. But when there are issues, you either get a divorce, you go through marriage counseling or whatever. No matter how much of a shrew she was, and I don't know, I'm not saying she was at all, it still doesn't excuse anything that he did. And so, you know, I think it's really interesting that he thinks that that's a winning strategy for him to blame her.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you what, I went through hours and hours of her social media because she was so connected online. Her whole business was online. Her personality was online. And I know it's not always the exact same person. But one thing I can say about Shanann Watts is that all she ever did is say how much she loved her husband. She constantly complimented him, said what a wonderful she just effusively talked about her children and her husband. So to have him say this after murdering her and forcing those two little girls to ride with their dead mother to their own oil-slicked graves, just, again, it is just so vile. Talk to me a little bit about his mentioning of his daughters. Does he acknowledge at all that he had daughters, that he loved them, that he's sorry that he did this to them?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to read you something. He says, the blessings of this life I've taken for granted. And those blessings, he talks about them being an olive tree, that type of thing. And then he starts to describe, like, their energy would last for days and on end. And sometimes their questions, too. And they would pick out a book about a train just to hear me say choo-choo. I mean, it sounds wonderful. You know, their kisses I thought would last forever. Hugs that would melt my heart. Never in a million years did I think we would be apart. Well, whose fault is that, Chris? Whose fault
is
that?
Almost, almost sorry that he misses them, but not sorry that he did this to them. Like, no apology.
Yeah, this is something
nothing.
That happened. He says, I didn't think that we would be apart. He doesn't say, I never thought that I would hurt them or anything like that. It's almost like there's this disassociation with what he did and that he just wants to go ahead and act like fate made this happen. And of course, we know that fate didn't make this happen. Chris Watts made this happen.
Yeah, you're right about the disassociation. I think it's a pathology almost that he's convinced. You know, OJ, I always say OJ, I don't think OJ believes that he killed those people. And I'm wondering if Chris Watts might be the same, is that he did this. And he is in a psychosis of some. I just can't imagine any other reason for this. What about the biblical tone that he takes in his writings? Like, he didn't seem to be much of a religious fella before he donned the orange jumpsuit.
No. He does say that he has converted to Christianity in prison, which, you know, obviously, great. You know, Christianity can be used for wonderful, wonderful things. But what he's doing here is using it to amplify his misogyny and use this to say, you know, to use the biblical terms of whore and harlot and things like that to talk about a woman who he was having sex with. So, you know, if she were a whore and a harlot, which she's not, what does that make you, Chris? You know, it's really interesting that he can use this and twist these scriptures and twist this idea to make it seem like it's all the woman's fault. And like I said before, it's misogyny that is wrapped in Bible verses.
Yeah, I just keep looking at his face and thinking, what happened to you? What happened? Because up until these horrible things, there didn't seem to be any indication that there was much wrong with him. I mean, it isn't great that he had that affair and was cheating with a pregnant wife and two beautiful daughters, but that does not lead us to believe that he's murderous. One last question. Any mention at all of the crimes, any new details, and any reaction from Nicole Kessinger, who was besmirched by all of this?
Nicole does not speak out about these things anymore. She gave one interview back in the day and that's done. You know, of course we reached out. We'll always reach out to her. She just doesn't want to talk about it. And I can't say that I blame her, to be honest. I mean, what does she have to gain to talk about this now? No, he's not giving new details about what he did. I mean, he was pretty clear in every police interview. By the time he started to cop to it, we kind of knew what he'd done. He doesn't give any new details because, again, this just happened to him. Ashley, it just happened. So, he doesn't give any more explanation of why or how or when or where. It just happened.
It just happened. It's just a murder that happened. Great work, as always, Steve Helling. You always get the goods with the Daily Mail. It's nice to have you on with the Daily Mail. Thanks, Steve. Have a great weekend.
See you soon.
All right, still to come, folks, an undocumented migrant goes on trial for the grisly murder of a Maryland mom of five. And the prosecutors describe a blood trail that was 150 feet long. It was Rachel Morin's blood, but it was also Rachel Morin's picture found on the accused killer's phone. And that is not a good fact. We learned so many new details of this heartless crime today, and our reporter was there for it all. She is live next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the go. I'm Chris Cuomo. This is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
In the world of true crime, the word bloody gets thrown around a lot. But today was exceptional in a Maryland courtroom. That's where prosecutors laid out the heinous details in the murder of Rachel Morin. Rachel was a mom of five, who was attacked while jogging on the Ma and Pa Trail in August of 2023. In opening statements in the trial of her alleged killer, prosecutors said volunteer searchers noticed a bloody rock. And then they followed a trail of blood for 150 feet into a drainage tunnel that was also spattered with blood. Before I go on, I want to paint a picture for you of what a 150-foot trail is like. If you live in a typical residential neighborhood, that is three front yards side by side. Now imagine a blood trail that long. Rachel Morin's body was mostly naked, and prosecutors say she was raped before she was strangled and beaten in the head repeatedly with a rock. The defendant is Victor Martinez Hernandez, a 23-year-old undocumented immigrant from El Salvador. It took investigators 10 months to find him, ID him, and bring him in. And why are they so sure that he's the guy? DNA, for starters, but that is not all. And yet his defense lawyers have a story to tell as well. Like, somebody else did it. Someone that she knew. Our national correspondent, Caitlin Becker, joins me now live from the Harford County Courthouse. And in the strangest juxtaposition, you are standing with the courthouse behind you. And in front of you is a night spot that Rachel used to frequent. And we can even hear the music from there.
Yeah, Ashley, the Tower Bel Air kind of got very lively within the last 20 minutes or so, and it is directly across the street from this courthouse. And I was talking to one of the security guards who's been kind of watching out for us here, and he says that the case gives him chills because he remembers Rachel Morin coming here and having fun. It's just a reminder that this was a beautiful woman who had a big, bright life. She had a boyfriend. She had five beautiful daughters. And then we find ourselves at opening statements today and listening to one, two, three, four, five witnesses for the prosecution lay out in detail what they think, what they believed happened to this woman. And it seems, Ash, at this point, that the prosecution, at least according to their opening statements, has a pretty strong case.
Can you lay out what they have on this defendant?
Well, first and foremost, they seem to have forensic evidence. They talked a lot about DNA. It's going to loom large in this case. They claim that the suspect's DNA was found in three places on Rachel Morin's body. We don't know specifically what type of DNA it is, if it was blood or fluids or hair or skin cells, but they say it was found on her neck. We know she was strangled. On her breasts and inside of her vagina. Those are three huge pieces of forensic evidence that they have, but that isn't all. As you just said, Ashley, there were also some Google searches that during the forensic search of his cell phone, they claim that the defendant searched Rachel's name, her first name, her last name, that he allegedly had photos of her on his phone and had a screenshot of an article about this case. So all of these things together does not look good for the defense, Ashley.
No, it sure doesn't. I'd be interested to find out about the photos, if he had the photos after her death or before her death. And in that respect, what does the defense have? Like, what kind of a case are they putting forth, at least from what we know in openings?
Well, I can answer that question for you. These images and these searches were after her death, not before. The defense is saying that he has no connection to her. So that actually does track with that he doesn't have a connection with her. The defense is pointing at the DNA evidence, claiming that at least in one instance in the vaginal swab, they say it wasn't a 100% match and that is what you need. They're pretty much saying it's not him, not the right guy, look in another direction. There are other people that could have been jealous of her. They claim that this was a crime of passion, that this was someone who wanted to humiliate her and not someone who just didn't know her. But I don't know if that was going to fly with the jury. They were very stone-faced and listened very intently in court, Ashley.
I think it's so weird that the defense is just giving it up that he has no connection to her, because the only way that I could see any kind of reasonable doubt is if they said, oh, well, he dated her briefly and they'd seen each other that morning, or they'd had coffee, or they were going to go on a run together and they got in a fight. But to actually concede he didn't know her, how on earth do they wiggle out of the fact that the defense, you know, has on its hands a 100% match, his DNA on her breast and then on her neck?
Yeah, you have these two huge pieces of DNA that they say are a 100% match. And then they're pointing at this third piece, claiming that it wasn't a 100% match. The experts haven't taken the stand yet to explain exactly why that is. But the prosecution said it is going to be in the billions and trillions of a chance that it could be someone else. So maybe it's not 100%, but it seems like it's pretty darn close. And as you've said, well, how did those other matches get there? Even if this third one isn't totally it, how did the rest of them get there? Leaning on the DNA. Yeah. Seems like not the smartest route to go for the defense in that way. Pointing the finger at other people might be their best bet to get that reasonable doubt, Ashley.
kind of feels like the slam dunk is getting closer even on day one. So Rachel's family, I cannot imagine what this has been like. Their lawyer told us this week that they'd been really kept out of the details, and so a lot of this would have been new to them. How did they manage in court, Caitlin?
You know, Ashley, I did speak to him today after opening statements when they heard some of those gruesome details that you had listed earlier about the blows to the head, the 150 feet of blood. And he said it was hard for them to listen to. Her mom, you could see, trying to fight back tears in that courtroom. But he did tell me that even though it is difficult, they know that they are able to leave if they need to, but they really want to stay there to be kind of a pillar of support for Rachel, who can't speak for herself and can't protect herself. So they're really trying to be there as hard as it is.
I have 10 seconds left, but any mention of this LA home invasion where they made the DNA match, when they found a match with the DNA of home invasion and an assault of a young person in LA, any mention of charges in that case?
It was in passing. I don't know if it's something they're going to be allowed to bring in. It could unfairly prejudice the jury there. So they really only came onto it in passing. But Ashley, I have to tell you, it was a really tough day in court. Her 14-year-old daughter testified through tears today. It was really emotional in there. It's going to be, I think, very hard for the jury to call themselves back.
Yeah, I think so too. Wen, there's a lot of politics in this case as well. Caitlin, great job. Thank you so much for doing this today. I want you to have a restful weekend.
Thank you.
Never easy to cover stories like this. You know, we often forget, right? You know, this is really hard for Caitlin to sit through and write about all day as well. Coming up next, from road rage to boat rage, does anybody really believe that this is the best charter captain we'll ever meet in our mother effing life?
I'm the best charter captain you'll ever meet in your mother effing life.
All right, bro.
Cuss me out.
Chill, bro. Chill, bro, please, bro.
If you thought fishing was supposed to be relaxing, have I got a story for you. Something took this boat bro from zero to crazy in minutes flat, and you'll see why 15 million people have ridden this wave. Next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream. Available 24/7 on the News Nation app, or just say, Alexa, play News Nation.
It's finally happened. Road rage has gotten so big it is not confined to the road anymore, or even to dry land. Get ready for open ocean rage. I take you to Punta Gorda, Florida, just north of Fort Myers on the Gulf. A charter captain and a few other men were in one boat. A young man fishing by himself was in another. The captain is angry about a close encounter a few hours earlier in the dark. But in his anger, he fails to listen to the young man's explanation that the hothead has mistaken him for another boat.
Were you the one that came through the middle of the bridge? Was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, I was here, but you ran in front of the other dude over there.
You were cussing me out, dude.
Bro, you ran right through the middle of the bridge while we were all fishing.
In the middle of the f***ing night, the guy didn't have any lights on.
Bro, we were all fishing here. The fucking.
All right,
bro. I'm not gonna do this with you, bro. I'm not gonna fucking do this with you, bro. Like, it's not the right time, bro.
You know the law?
Bro, you can't come flying through the middle of the fucking bridge, bro.
Bullshit. Yes, I can.
All right, bro. What are you trying to do, bro? What are you trying to do, bro?
You want to fucking go?
I don't want to fucking go. I want you to get the fuck out of here.
Big tough guy.
Tough guy? You pulled up on me, motherfucker.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
What are you gonna do about it?
Nah, I'm fishing, you fucking. Like, bro, get out of here. Like, what? What are you trying to do? Act like a tough guy in front of your buddies?
No, I'm not. Dude, all these motherfuckers know I'm tough, motherfucker.
Bro, all right, bro.
You know what?
Get going, bro.
We're all fucking war veterans. We're all Rangers.
Well, thank you for your service, bro.
And you're gonna talk shit.
Thank you for your service, bro. But that doesn't give you the right. All right, bro. All right, whatever. I appreciate you for your service, bro. But you don't got to run through the middle of the bridge, bro.
Let me pause for a couple of introductions here. The cranky captain that you're looking at, that is Brock Horner. He's the owner of Tarpon Coast Fishing Charters. That's him there. It is not clear whether the other guys are actually buddies or whether they are clients of his. The man who's shooting the video is Gage Tolles, 22 years old and all alone in his boat. He posted the 5-minute clip on his socials, where it has now been viewed more than 15 million times. So far, these bros are just flexing, but neither is backing down. So naturally, it escalates.
I'm 300 days a year on the motherfucking water.
All right,
every
bro.
Every day, I'm the best charter captain you'll ever meet in your motherfucking life.
All right, bro.
Cuss me out.
Chill, bro. Chill, bro. Please, bro.
Don't hit the
f***ing please, okay, please, bro. Please, bro. Please, bro. Bro, I'm a kid, bro, please.
Apologize.
Oh, I'm sorry, bro. I'm sorry, bro.
You're gonna cuss me the f***
all right, bro.
In the middle of the
no, bro, please, bro. Please, bro.
Get me back to my boat.
Okay, please.
F***ing apologize.
I'm sorry, bro. That was not me, bro.
Yes, it was, bro.
I was here, but my buddy was
take
on the boat.
Take me back to my
yes, sir. I'm a kid, bro, please, bro.
I don't care. You don't cuss me
yes,
the f***
sir.
Out.
All right.
Talk f- to me, mother f***.
Yes, sir.
You don't do it. Do I'm... it again and watch what f***ing happens.
Hey, get back on this boat.
Do it again.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, bro. Like, I appreciate y'all, bro. For, like, I'm sorry, bro.
The wrong
bro, yes, sir.
Okay, argument over, but the fallout, that is just beginning. This happened on Tuesday, and already Brock Horner's lawyer says it's destroyed his business and it's damaged his reputation. The lawyer also says of this aggressor, quote, first and foremost, Brock sincerely apologizes to Gage and to Gage's family and to anyone who was frightened or upset by what they saw. He is deeply sorry. What began as a moment of frustration and concern escalated in a way it simply should not have. Gage handled the situation with impressive composure and class, and that level-headedness helped prevent things from becoming far worse. Brock is not proud of how he acted, but it's important to remember we are not the sum of our worst day. That video captured one moment, not the whole of who he is. Last we checked, the website for Brock Horner's business was offline and his social media accounts were all scrubbed. And yes, Punta Gorda Police, Florida Fish and Wildlife, and the U.S. Coast Guard are all investigating this. There is a moral to this story, something about being the bigger man, but really, at the end of the day, just chill. Go fishing, bro. Still to come, the most infamous mob trial, the day that signaled the end for the most infamous mobster since Al Capone. He had plenty of nicknames, but the most memorable one was Teflon Don. So coming up next, how did John Gotti's life come crashing down 33 years ago this week?
I was raised on the east side myself in Los Angeles, and that was the worst sin.
It is a true crime rewind, and it's coming up next.
The biggest trials in America, and Banfield is all over them. Lori Vallow, Karen Reed, the Menendez brothers. You know their names. Now see how justice unfolds. Could Lori Vallow be convicted in the murder of her fourth husband? Will Karen Reed's second trial end with a verdict or another mistrial? And what will happen at the Menendez brothers' resentencing? Plus, all eyes are on the trial of the illegal immigrant accused of killing jogger mom Rachel Morin. The case isn't closed until you've seen it on Banfield, only on News Nation.
33 years ago, this week, the man who made famous the nickname Teflon Don saw his decades-long crime spree come to an end. And I don't mean the Teflon Don in the Oval Office. I mean this Teflon Don, John Gotti. John Gotti was the biggest kingpin that organized crime has really ever seen in America, and he was seemingly unconvictable, hence the name Teflon Don. He was a mob boss who loved the spotlight and probably didn't mind the other nickname he had either, Dapper Don, because he was flashy and he was loud. But all that bravado came to an end April 2nd, 1992. On that day, a very brave New York jury found John Gotti guilty of every charge the feds threw at him, including murder. And our News Nation affiliate WPIX had a front row seat. I give you tonight's True Crime Rewind. Good evening. It's a guilty verdict that prosecutors hope breaks the back of organized crime in New York City.
Gambino crime boss John Gotti and his co-defendant Frank LoCascio guilty on a host of felonies that could send them to prison for the rest of their lives. Barry Cunningham was at the Brooklyn Federal Court when the verdict came in.
A supremely confident John Gotti had spent most of his 7 weeks on trial thumbing his nose at the prosecutor, muttering obscenities against the government, and laughing off testimony that he is the godfather of the nation's richest and most murderous crime family. It took only a day and a half of deliberations for the anonymous, sequestered jury to wipe the smile off Gotti's face. Tough guy Gotti took it on the chin over and over and over again as the jury forewoman repeatedly pronounced him guilty of murdering his way to the top of the Gambino crime syndicate. In the spectator benches, several well-dressed members of the Gambino gang cursed the jury out loud as the clerk recorded guilty verdicts on all 13 counts of murder, conspiracy to murder, racketeering, illegal gambling, loan sharking, obstruction of justice, and tax fraud. Gotti's underboss in the Gambino mob, Frank LoCascio, was also convicted of murder and racketeering, acquitted only on a single count of illegal gambling. They've called Gotti the Teflon Don because the government has been unable to make the charges stick against him in three previous trials.
The Teflon is gone, the Don is covered with Velcro, and every charge in the indictment stuck. It's been a long road. Justice has been served, and it feels awfully good.
The government maintained that the best evidence against John Gotti was his own voice, secretly recorded on FBI surveillance tapes.
You fellas talk, I'm with John Gotti, you're setting your mother head off. You know better than me.
Gotti was heard discussing the daily business of the Cosa Nostra, everything from gangland rubouts and labor racketeering payoffs to his own recipe for cooking pasta with lentils.
If John Gotti was acquitted, I thought it would give a shot in the arm to organized crime throughout the United States, and John Gotti would achieve a status that not even Al Capone or others in the past have achieved. I was convinced if John Gotti was convicted, it would be the death knell for organized crime, traditional organized crime as we know it in the United States, and I think that's what happened. I'm not going to say it's going to be gone in a year, but the mob, as we have known it, in New York City and in the United States, is on the way out.
Gotti's lawyers were stunned by the swiftness of the verdict, which could put Gotti in prison for life with no parole.
He took it like a real man, and he has vowed that the fight is not over, ladies and gentlemen, and it's not, I warrant you.
Just as surprising as the swiftness of the guilty verdict was how completely the jury believed the government star witness, Mafia turncoat Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano, John Gotti's best friend and betrayer. The bad news for organized crime in America is that Gravano is now set to testify against other gangland leaders in other cities. In the words of the federal prosecutor, they're next. At the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse, Barry Cunningham, Channel 11, News at 10.
Well, prosecutors call the verdict a victory for justice, but there is a very different opinion on the streets of Howard Beach. Ed Miller is standing by now in John Gotti's neighborhood. Ed?
Katie, the curious carnival continues tonight outside the Gotti family household. People from all over driving by trying to get a close-up look at where the dapper Don used to hang all his expensive gabardine suits and silk ties. On the front lawn, in the middle of a tree, hangs a single yellow ribbon, symbolizing the hopeful return of the family patriarch. For up until today, many neighbors and family members truly believed that John Gotti would soon be coming home. John Gotti's daughter, Victoria, clearly upset, covering her face, dashing out of the family house tonight, refusing to talk. But earlier, right after the verdict was announced, she wondered out loud whether anyone believed the government won fair and square, accusing the prosecution of overstepping its boundaries. Many others in Howard Beach tonight agree.
I don't know. I don't like it at all. I think he should have gotten off.
There'll be an appeal and he'll get off because it was very unfair.
I think this government sucks. That's all set up.
He wasn't guilty. You know, he's just trying to make a living like everybody else.
Yeah, I think they pulled a lot of dirty tricks. And I don't believe their witness.
All the jurors said he was guilty unanimously beyond a shadow of a doubt. I guess he was.
I think he got what he deserved.
Really? I agree.
If all these things that they say about him are true, what the government says about him are true, then he probably does deserve to go to jail. But it's just, I just never really felt that he was really like that.
This government's no good. Should be out. He's
a good guy. He does a lot for the community, you know. Put him away for naught.
After initially showing some signs of wanting to speak out about what happened today, the family has now gone into hiding. It is not clear at this hour exactly where John Gotti Jr. is, or for that matter, where Mrs. Gotti is. Reporting live in Howard Beach, I'm Ed Miller. Back to you.
1992. Still to come. We weren't the only ones scratching our heads over claims by Virginia Giuffre that she is dying after being hit by a school bus. Now the driver of that bus is speaking out with a very different story. And guess what? Prince Andrew is saying something too. Can you imagine what? You'll hear it next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the go. I'm Elizabeth Vargas. We're here for you 24/7 on the News Nation app or on your Alexa. Just say play News Nation.
The last time Virginia Giuffre was in the news as much as she has been this week, she was helping bring down Jeffrey Epstein, who trafficked her as a teenager for sex. She also brought down Prince Andrew, an Epstein cohort whom Giuffre accused of rape. And the prince is not holding back about the headlines that Giuffre is making in Australia right now. As you've probably heard, she posted that she's dying from a serious injury or serious injuries after a bus accident over there. The police, however, said that the crash was minor, and the bus driver, he actually laughed when he saw Giuffre's post because he says the crash was little more than a bump. A friend of Prince Andrew's told the Daily Beast that the royal is, quote, completely unsurprised that Giuffre's claim of having just 4 days to live has been discredited. Andrew's friend also says that this, quote, brought back the sadness the entire family feel that this woman was allowed to ruin Andrew's life. No mention that this photo may have actually been what ruined Andrew's life. His sweaty hand on the bare waist of a 17-year-old girl with Ghislaine Maxwell in the background, who's a convicted sex offender. So, all right, that's it for tonight. But don't forget, Drop Dead Serious, my podcast is out. I've got a brand new episode that just dropped last night. And it is a great episode with Bob Mata from the Defense Diaries, just going through every piece of the Karen Reed trial with me. Not only that, we've got the jury questionnaire up there on Drop Dead Serious and Lori Vallow's courtroom antics. See for yourself her little outbursts and the sparring with the judge. It's really quite something. Thanks so much for being with me here this week. Stick around. Cuomo starts.